Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Education Is podcast. As always, I'm your host, Nicole Forsyth, here with...
Welcome, everyone. This is Alan Turka talking.
And we're so pleased to have Sean, is it Cornelly or Cornelly?
Cornelly.
Sean Cornelly with us from, I was going to say a high school physics teacher, but you do so many other different things. So we're going to talk about the many things that you do, but I wonder if you'll introduce yourself and tell us what you think you do.
Sure. My name's Sean, and I just really like teaching kids stuff. And my job, I guess I don't know how to put it now that you put it that way. I'm obsessed with the idea that students should think school is the most important and fun thing they can ever do, and they should be sad to not be doing it. And that's the environment that I want to create in the creative corridor.
Fantastic. Part of the reason I was... When I was trying to think of how to introduce you, I was just listing out a handful of the things that Sean has done. You've been a physics teacher, a math teacher. You do professional development for other teachers. You're a writer and a blogger, lots of different projects. And you're working currently on a project called the Big Idea School?
Yeah.
Big Idea Group. Okay.
Yeah, and that's this is the sort of culmination of the past 5 years of my career, is that we recently approached some of the school districts in Cedar Rapids and Iowa City and shot them this idea of, what if we created a competency-based school, much like what Des Moines is talking about right now, or not Des Moines, by that I mean the legislature, not the Des Moines public school system. This competency-based ed system where the students don't receive grades, but they receive, you know, publicly facing competencies, and a place where the students aren't governed by time, but they're governed by, again, what they know and how long it takes them to learn things, a place where the students aren't governed by what building they go to or a bell schedule, but instead they're governed by their actual, you know, interest in a project and getting it done and finding a place, finding an audience for that kind of work. And we just kind of floated that idea out there, and I said, you know what, I'm just going to quit my job and do it, and I'll take 15 kids and I'll just, you know, live the, you know, noodle lifestyle here for a little bit until we can make it work. And we just found out that there are some districts that are going to put some money behind this, and we're going to have a bunch of students, and so we're going to give this model a try next year. I'm pretty excited about it.
Such a fabulous thing, and there's so many layers of things to talk about here. So one is, okay, so how do you handle issues of curriculum? Like, how do you handle, I think I know, but let's have you lay it all out there for us.
I mean, that's the first question that everyone asks us. And the answer is that, one, it's not as hard to cover material as people think it is, right? And I know that's a sort of seasoned teacher saying that. Right, and I know a bunch of teachers that would be in college thinking to themselves, "My God, I don't know how I'm going to get through anything." In the end, the really important stuff shows up. I mean, the things that you actually need to know, the things that you will actually use, the things that are meaningful beyond just a bunch of garbage, odd-numbered problems from the back of a math book. I mean, that stuff shows up, right? And it shows up real in real life as soon as you try to do anything meaningful. So I'm not so much worried about what curriculum I'm going to cover. I'm worried about doing too much, right? I'm worried about these kids seeing too much and connecting too many things and not having the time to really reflect on it and internalize it completely. And that's the problem that we have here in the, you know, what we call the creative corridor. There's just too much going on, which is really, really, really exciting because it didn't used to be that way, at least when I was in high school. So as far as curriculum goes, the kids, when they enroll, they declare a concentration. And so they come in thinking, oh, this is just school. You know, okay, we'll do some weird stuff, and like he'll plan some projects for us, and we'll do them. So they come in and say, I want to learn physics. And I say, okay. You know, you sort of give them a wink. And then you sort of start to ask them about what they're into, and it turns into these projects, and it's like, oh, well, you know, you could probably end up down at, like, the dam and, like, you know, measure some stress and strain on that. And they're like, oh, yeah, that'd be cool. And then they go down there. And then, of course, the minute they get out into the real world, 6 billion questions crush down on them, and they're like, oh, there's 1,000 ways I could go with that, all of them equally valid for this one particular piece of curriculum. And then you win. Like, the whole rest of the semester is planned out, you know, and then, but if the kid doesn't find that interesting, then they just naturally don't find that interesting, and so you don't do that. So I really trust the real world to, like, bring that in, but in the end, I have to, as a teacher, I have to believe in that. And there are many teachers who don't, which is why this is an education option, right? Some kids want a regular high school and a regular high school experience. We know that there are some people out there who consider themselves doers, or, you know, people who learn by doing. You know, there's always those kids that say that. And what they really mean is that they need to be processing that, whatever it is, to actually understand. They need to be, like, performing it and doing it.
Do you think you were a kid like that when you were going through
school? No, I wasn't, man. I was the worst. I was a video game overweight, just sat around, went to school, did the homework, went home, did nothing.
And you were happy with that kind of model. You were getting something out of it anyway. You were kind of going through the
model. Yeah, I mean, it's just like every other student. You think you're happy. Yeah. You know, you think to yourself, like, oh, these Cheetos are delicious. And I just beat level 7. Like, I will have friends. And then you get to be about 22 years old, and you think to yourself, my God, I don't have any applicable skills to do anything to, like, give back to humanity, right? The front part of your brain finally, like, matures, and you're like, I'm worthless to everybody. And you don't know what to, like, you know, you don't know what to do about that. And so, like, I freaked out, and I'm thinking, man, all of my friends who have been doing something now do something. And I'm, like, fighting to even get an internship at the age of 23 or 22. Like, this is not how I should have been mentored when I was younger, you know?
Hmm. So how, like, what will the age of the students be in the Big Idea group?
Yeah, we went with Big Idea Group instead of school because the acronym is big and we like that.
Oh, sure.
Right now it's 9-12.
Okay.
We want to do 7-12 eventually. But because we're a school without walls, which means our students spend a majority of their time, whether that's 51% or, you know, 90%, whatever, they spend a majority of their time outside of the building. And our building is located at Vault, which is the co-working space in downtown Cedar Rapids. And we'll also have some space that the Cedar Rapids Economic Alliance is freeing up for us that will get the kids interacting with established businesses a little bit more. So Vault is kind of our, like, hippie entrepreneurial side. And then we have this sort of Economic Alliance, like, let's get you in at Rockwell kind of vibe. But we don't see students being in the actual, like, classroom space more than, 3 to 4 hours a week. And then their other sort of 3 to 4 hours will be spent, you know, at the dam, at the business they're paired with, talking to people, doing interviews, you know, shooting video, whatever it is that they're actually doing to actually learn something. And I guess the acid test for our school is, will our students be proud of what they made and keep it? Because I just quit my job at a high school, and you know what I saw? I saw a bunch of kids take their entire lockers, grab them from the top, and just dump them in a trash can, and then walk out. And I thought to myself, man, like, I know that's funny and, like, very dazed and confused, but God, like, all that work and time and energy that you put into that and you just threw it away, obviously that had no meaning. Like, that's screwed up. Like, that, this should not be the way things are still working a decade after I graduated.
So on this podcast, we've talked a little bit about motivation, and I was struck somewhere as I was reading on your blog that you said you're fully, completely, and 100% over using grades as motivation and punishment for students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that sums it up, right?
I mean, yeah, pretty much. Because, I always sort of thought grades, you know, I was kind of one of those students myself where it was like, it was very easy for me to get A's. I never really had to work all that hard. You know, I just kind of got it done. I mean, sort of lucky me, but it also meant that I didn't have a lot of respect for the things I was working on, and I was always kind of vaguely dissatisfied. Like, surely this paper isn't perfect. I would like some feedback, and instead I just kind of get the A, and it's good enough. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I've always thought grades were sort of poor motivation and kind of poor punishment. So I just love this idea of kind of a grade-free world. So what does assessment in that grading sort of sense mean for you in your either your Big Idea world or in your life as a teacher?
I mean, that's a loaded question, right? So as soon as you start talking about grading, you're going to make a lot of people really mad, right? Because some people will see grading as the way to control their school. And if you take that away from them, they literally see anarchy. Like, they imagine teenagers naked, burning things in corners, you know? Like, it just, I mean, that's literally what they imagine. And so you say, oh, I haven't given a grade in 2 years. And they think, you have Lord of the Flies happening in your classroom. This is insane, you know? And that's not really what it's like. I guess I was in my first year, and a teacher that taught right next to me, he was a math teacher, he's an administrator now, he asked me, you know, what do your quizzes or do your students use your quizzes how you want them to? I thought, what kind of a question is that? What do you mean, how do they, you know? I give them quizzes because I want to give them a quiz. And he goes, why do you want to give them a quiz? I'm like, because you do that every week. Like, that's just what you do, right? And he's like, okay. And I thought about it, and then, you know, you can sort of see the rabbit hole opening up and swallowing you in, and then I realized, like, oh my God, like, I'm just doing that because I saw other people do it. And I, you know, the kids aren't using that. They're hiding from that information. You know, I give them back a poor quiz. Well, they just, you know, they throw it away. Well, that's not what that was for, you know? I give them back an excellent quiz. What do? They throw it away, and they choose not to retain that material, and so they can't, you know, do anything else with it later. And so I realized the whole thing's a sham, right? The whole thing's a joke. So this whole idea that grading is somehow this like rock of school that like holds everything together, and if you don't build it on top of a good GPA, you're screwed. I mean, all that's complete farce. Like, it's psychologically ridiculous, right? And you just Google Alfie Cohn and then like spend the next 6 years of your life like, you know, growing dreadlocks, because that's what will happen. And what really matters is you'll notice what kids actually care about when you mention is feedback. That's all they freaking want. That's it. That's all. You ask a kid, what did you like about this class? Oh, it's when you talked to me personally about my work. Oh, it wasn't when I gave you a 4 out of 4? No, that didn't matter at all. But as soon as I do put a 4 out of 4 on something, they don't read the feedback, which to me sort of smacks of this kind of psychological conditioning that we've done to students and ourselves, right? If someone gives me $1,000 to do something, I don't care how amoral it was, right? As long as it's not hurting me, I might do it again. Like, well, that's, you know, it's, all of this is connected to this bizarre psychology of rewards. So anyways, I think a better rock to build on is the feedback rock, right? Where you're saying, do this project, no, you can't pass the class until it's good. That's a way different mentality for students to have, right? They're thinking to themselves, well, I can't just turn in garbage and be done with it. Yeah. Like, if it was worth doing, we're just going to keep going until it's worth doing. And then, oh, by the way, you know, at this monthly show of learning, right, which is, we have it, we're hopefully going to have it at the Art Museum downtown. We'll have a gallery space for student work and presentations. The public is invited, and the public decides if the student's proficient. And if the public decides they aren't, I'll get back to work. Like, you're not, you know, we're not producing, this isn't just a joke for you to get through 100 hours of school. Like, this is for you to be a generative member of American society, right? Or, you know, like, we need people to, like, build stuff that works. So that's, this whole idea that grading is this rock that school is built on is just a total sham. And you see it, especially at places like Kirkwood, where you have students that are entering a college environment that some aren't ready. And they end up, the grades end up destroying their mentality about school. And that, I mean, I was an adjunct here, just like everyone else in the universe for a while. And I saw that. Like, you give a kid back their first paper and it didn't have the grade they wanted on it, they drop the class. Like, what a bizarre reaction. I mean, we're seeing, it's not Kirkwood's fault, we're seeing the tail end of a, you know, 12 years of abuse. Like, of course you're going to shy away, you know, they're gun shy of grades. That's messed up. So, yeah, sorry, that's a loaded question.
What? A loaded question? No.
Never on this podcast.
We're completely objective.
Yeah.
Journalism at its finest.
Yeah. What if any, I'm trying to unload the question maybe a little bit. What if any results have you seen in terms of the way you're restructuring the grading process with the students who you've had in your classes, mm-hmm. maybe going on either to college or to just other classes in the high school environment?
Well, the best experiment, or the most successful experiment that I've done was this last semester, where I said, I made a deal with a class on the first day. I said, you know what, I'm not going to give you a grade. I'm not going to give you points. I'm not going to give you quizzes. I'm not going to give you tests. And they're all like, oh, sweet. You know, I'm like, but here's what we're going to do. You're going to write, and you're going to write, and you're going to draw, and you're going to show, take pictures, and you're going to explain, and you're going to give presentations, and you're going to talk to people who don't understand this, and you're going to teach that to them. And you and I are going to decide when you get something or when you don't. And you're going to, you know, and that turned into this thing like, oh, okay, that sounds okay. And it turned into kids, honestly, I mean, I had a girl write probably 50, 60,000 words about physics too, right? She was taking electricity and magnetism. I mean, she wrote about every single thing we did. And she would write about it, and then she would send me an email and say, would you read this? Comment on it. I don't think I get the part about what we did with magnets today. And she would take pictures of everything. And I noticed, like, every kid was taking pictures of everything they did because they knew the way they were going to get assessed was by giving a narrative of what they had learned, right, and getting feedback on it. And I would write things on their just, you know, comment, like in WordPress. I would say, hey, you know, you did not explain this, like, correctly. Like, that you have some pretty serious content errors here. And they would say, well, where? And I would say, you know, if I told you that, you know? And so they would literally have to, you know, sort of pull through that, which is exactly the work that I expected them to do after I would give them a traditional quiz, but they never did. So by getting rid of grading, I actually got all of the things from traditional assessment that I had been striving for that first couple years of teaching. So that was my most recent experiment, and those were with traditional high school students. As far as sort of, like, what does the data show, right? The students that have graduated from this sort of, like, hippie environment really show no difference in college, other than they report now that they feel like they understand how to study a little bit better. But in general, what we see is I see a level of confidence in the students, but I have to admit the N is not so huge because when they go to college, they tend to sort of like float into the sea and disappear, right? And they don't really come back to like take your little survey. But
hard to keep in touch with students once they go on to their lives, perhaps.
I try through Facebook. I probably have friended like a couple hundred of current and former students on like a teacher account that I have set up. But that's difficult because, you know, you never know if you're cherry picking the kinds of students that want to talk to you. So that's not, you know, the most reportable data. So I don't know. I mean, that college question is an interesting and researchable question.
One thing that in some of your writing I've really pulled out, and you just mentioned it yourself, is kind of like the narrative arc of inquiry. And I just loved that term, like as a sort of written term. But I wonder if you can kind of unpack what you mean, if you have any concrete examples of how students have authentically engaged in kind of a narrative arc of inquiry.
Sure. So by that, I literally mean like literature, right? Like you literally have an exposition and a beginning setup, and you have this sort of rising action. You have this climax, then you have the fallout, right, of where this goes next. And if it's a George R. R. Martin book, like everyone just dies at the end and you're like sad about it. But spoiler alert. what's a good example of one that has recently happened? Okay, my kids built a power glove, right? Like a Nintendo power glove, you know, where you can like control the game with your fingers and like there's buttons on it and stuff. And I showed them this movie, right? The old Nintendo Power movie where like the kid puts the power glove on and he's like has superpowers and stuff. And they were like laughing about it. I'm like, does that actually work? And they're like, yeah. And they're like, let's make one. And so they started, it started off with this ridiculous question and introduction of a character, this power glove. And to a student, that's a character. This invention that they don't quite understand or this technology that they don't quite get. Which, as an interesting aside, there's some research that just came out of the University of Iowa that shows that the students who win things like the Google Science Fair and the Siemens grants and the end up in these really crazy internships, the only thing they have in common, like they don't have parentage or ethnicity or or SES, none of that they have in common. The only thing they have in common is they took stuff apart, right? That's it. They interviewed like 30 of these kids that got these huge, full rides to MIT and stuff like that. All they did was take stuff apart. So anyways, that's become pretty much my entire curriculum. So we got a power glove, right? And the kids like dissect it. And they start to figure out, well, how does it work? Well, it has stuff in the fingers, right? So we order some like flex sensors for the fingers. And they're like, okay, well, it has a brain in it, right? It has like a computer chip. Well, they don't know what any of that is. So my job then becomes like to sort of level that time. Like it would have taken them months to understand how that computer worked. But as a teacher, I see that and I think, man, what is it useful enough for them to figure that out on their own? Or do I stop and kind of hit fast forward on the content? And I decided, yeah. So we ordered a bunch of microcontrollers, Arduino boards, which are really sort of popular now in like maker culture. And we ordered some of those. I'm like, here's how these work. And they're like, okay. I'm like, okay, your job now is to figure out how the power glove uses it. And so they like messed around with it. And they're like, okay, you hook the flex sensor up here, and here's how it reads the voltage on it. And like, okay, now we can have five. And they opened the glove up and like soldered it in the glove. So now we're like building the characters, right? Like it feels like a book. Like you can imagine a montage of this. And we should have made a montage. And you can imagine, and so they start building this thing, and they plug it into the board, and they plug it into the computer, and they're like, okay, someone write a program that like shows us that it's working. And then this girl's like, I can kind of do that. And so like she starts to like program this thing where it like flashes different colors when you make the different fingers go. And that's like as simple as the program gets. And then they make it work. But then one of the fingers doesn't work. And so you can see how you have these like sort of like little problems on the way. And then we hit the climax where some kid goes, okay, well this is stupid. Like what should we make it do? And they like they all just explode. They're like, we could have like a tank game where you like control the tank with treads, or like it could be like a bird and you have to like flap your wings and you can like turn by flapping different speeds. And it could be like an airplane where you fly it through, I don't know, whatever. And so they start to like come up with all these crazy ideas, and they're like doling out who's going to program what and figure out how to make the program draw circles and make the program do whatever. And so you have this big climax, and then the next, the day that they like, it like finally works, and they've been working on it and programming it and reiterating on it, and then it finally works, and they like play the game for a day. And then it has the same feeling as if, like, just like you almost have that remorse of finishing a good book, right? You're like, damn, I loved Harry and like Hermione and Ron, they were like my friends, and now there's nothing left. You know, and they have like this remorse, and they're like, oh, I guess we did that. Okay. And you sort of like stare around, and you're like, oh, I guess the story's over. Like, let's do something new. And like, you can palpably feel that. And then I asked myself the question, like, how do I grade that? Well, I mean, so each one of them learned something about electronics, something about design, something about engineering, something about programming, something about physics. And it's like, I don't know. I mean, you assess them while they're working, and you find out what kid doesn't get it. And then the next day, it's really easy to say, hey, you 20, or you 15, or you 6, sit down, let's talk this over. The rest of you start looking for inspiration somewhere else. You get it. And it just becomes so much easier than teach this crap on the board, take a test, you didn't get it, what are you going to do about it? Well, nothing, because we're moving on. And like, that just seems so, like, fake to me. Mm-hmm. So there's an example of an arc, yeah.
Yeah, and I, you know, the thing that also had me curious, so I was an English major in school, and I'm like, Sean's a science teacher, surely science to you. Like, what does he mean, narrative arc? I think that's something, too, that gets to what you were just talking about, like, these disciplines that we have, to the legacy of the history of the way we've educated people. And I was just looking at this handout that I keep right by my desk, and it's from Pacific Crest, and it's about, like, the transformation of education, moving from things like memorizing to problem solving. I mean, this is pretty teacher jargony, you know, from rigid to responsive design. And I was just thinking about, in terms of disciplines, because in the library we struggle with, you know, traditionally, how do you organize books? Do you organize it by discipline or by related topics? Anyway, that's my little kind of nerdy world.
Books are organized in a library?
I know, it's crazy. I love the way that you're talking and thinking about school as a holistic, you're there as a person, and you're not just there as like a representative of this one school of thought. Like a real crossing of disciplines that's authentic. And
well, that's a hard thing to buy, though, when you're a teacher. Because when you go to teacher prep school and you're a pre-service teacher, they tell you, manage your classroom. Don't have discipline problems. Like, those are the things that people really talk about on a daily basis. If you ask any pre-service teacher what their number one concern is, it's managing the students. Keeping them engaged, not having, you know, not managing the students. And maybe they all sort of come to this idea that having engaging lessons will manage their classroom, but not everyone gets there.
Yeah. This is really interesting because I'm thinking about discipline like sociology versus physics, not necessarily discipline like, hey, kids, sit down and be quiet.
Yeah, oh, okay,
but that's,
yeah.
You know,
no, that too, as well,
they're both
yeah.
super, I mean, that's an interesting word, discipline.
How hard was it for you to be, or how hard is it to be in the class where students are struggling with these concepts and really being engaged together, and then for you to just kind of step back, or maybe you are more involved?
At first, it's not very fun. Right? At first, the students don't really understand what you're asking. When you say, for example, a really fantastic lesson that's really quick is my wife and I were having a fight about how long I should have to hold the baby right after it's born. And of course, me being a scientist, like, I couldn't just shut up about it, right? Or a mathematician. I was like, well, really, I mean, it wasn't that big for most of the pregnancy. So, like, when it comes out, you know, I mean, it's bigger, so the timing is different. And she's like, are you making this argument? I'm like, well, I'm just making a math argument. I'm not saying it's really true. I'm saying, you know, my time is probably more like 3.5 months to have that integral be the same as the integral of, you know, this lower weight of the child. And so I just explain that story to my students and let them roll with it. And they were like, well, what do we do with that? You know, and some of them look at you like, plan something for me, you know, be a teacher, do something. And I'm thinking to myself, my God, like, I'm spitting you gold here. Like, there's literally nothing else I could do as a teacher but, like, give you this prompt and let you roll with it. And so those kids, there's kids that look at you and say, I don't know where to go with that. I don't have a question about that. And they're always lying, right? Because if you probe them, if you, like, push them a little bit further, they always have a question. They just don't realize that, like, you value it. And that's, I mean, this sounds very, like, you know, white person dreadlocks a little here, but, like, they literally believe that if they have a question about some material, they should not say it. And I know, I mean, that sounds so, like, I don't know, like, totalitarian or, like, you know, 1984 type of conditioning. But it really is that way. Like, you ask a kid, what question do you have about that story? And they'll just stare at you, waiting for you to tell them the thing that you want them to do with it. And so at first it's really awkward. And then one kid says, how long do you have to hold the baby? And you're like, yes, that's where we might be going with this. Another kid goes, well, don't pregnant women, like, gain a whole bunch of other weight that's, like, not just the baby to, like, support the baby? And then, you know, someone else is like, yeah, my mom gained, like, 100 pounds. And then, you know, like, it just goes from there. And then another kid will ask something like, well, like, I mean, is every fetus the same size? And now you won. Like, they're asking mathematics questions that don't have the, like, salt crust of school on it. Like, these are real questions. And then, you know, an almost awkward amount of time into the day, you actually have kids sitting at computers looking up information that's actually valid. And then you all come to an agreement on how the report's going to look. And that's the hardest part, is you say, like, okay, are we going to, like, report this out to each other? Are you just going to put it on whiteboards and we're going to talk about it? Do you think we should write something? And that's the hardest part, is, like, putting that, like, final bit on there. But at first, like, the kids really don't believe you that you care about their questions. Because they normally, like, you know, honestly, most educators don't.
And so you spend a lot of time sort of validating their questions?
Yeah, I mean, too much time, right? I mean, I waste time doing that because the kids are so averse to it. I mean, that's the most frustrating part of doing my job, I think, is trying to get a kid to be curious about something that's actually interesting. Because they'll see something interesting and they think to themselves, well, that can't be at school. I like that. And they don't really think that, but it's, you know, it's subconscious. Like, I like snowmobiling and I want to become a pilot. Well, those aren't classes at school, so he shows up to math class and just sort of, like, zombies through parabolas. I mean, you don't blame the kid for not throwing his question out there.
Okay, so let's move on to another interesting sure. interesting project that you've done that I'm super curious someday to maybe try to bring to Kirkwood. Tell me about your bacon-wrapped lessons professional development for teachers.
That is fun, and you should totally bring it to Kirkwood. And
you want to come?
Yes, let's do it.
I don't know how to make that happen, but I will.
We send you a proposal, and you send us the number of teachers, and then we work the money out through Grantwood AEA, and we just do it.
Rock and roll.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Super fun. So we had a bacon-wrapped lessons workshop in February of this year, I think 16, 17, February 16, 17. And it was 70 math and science teachers from all over the state. And they came to the Marriott, and we basically sat them down and said, here are 150 whiteboards. Write down the worst thing that's ever happened in your classroom. Write down the worst lesson you've ever taught. Write down the content that you literally would rather call in sick and just have the sub show a movie. Write down the worst, right? And then we put them all in this, like, big circular rack so that everyone could see. It was like a tornado of horrible lessons, right? And they're all just sort of looking at it. And then we said, okay, you know what? Grab the one you think you can fix. And so people would grab one, like trigonometric identities, which, right? Grabs it and holds it up in the air, and then anyone else who thinks that they can, like, want to fix that or it's a problem for them, like, gravitates towards that person. And then they went and moved back to their tables, and they actually started to sit down. And the first step in the bacon-wrapped triage process is to, like, honestly, you know, sort of have, like, an AA meeting. Like, hi, I'm Sean. I teach trigonometry poorly. You know, like, because I don't know what else to do. And then everyone else says the exact same thing. And so you end up, like, 20 minutes into this process of bacon-wrapping a lesson, you end up with this, like, honestly, very AA kind of vibe. Like, at least we're all having a problem, you know, with this. And because teachers really believe that every other teacher is really good and they're bad. And so they won't talk about things. The same with professors, right? When I was at Kirkwood, I would go to the other teachers teaching my class, and they wouldn't talk about what we were doing. You know, it was very, or the rhetoric was very much like, we know we're all doing a great job. And my rhetoric is always like, I know I'm doing the worst job ever, right? Because these kids still don't know stuff, right? So in the bacon-wrapped lesson, you can imagine where it goes from there, right? They start to, it quickly turns from complaining into solving. And then we have instructional coaches that we've kind of found through Twitter and people that I think are very energetic about student engagement and, you know, kind of my, like, hand-picked, like, team of people. And they would go from each table kind of bouncing around and just listening to what the people had to say, and they would just kind of shove them towards student-centered, inquiry-based, asking a good question, starting a narrative arc that the kids can finish, right? All these sorts of things. And so we had, like, 70 people and probably, like, 15 coaches in this room and just all circling around. And we ended up, you know, our vernaculars, we ended up curing and smoking, I think, like, 150 different really difficult lessons. And they're all math and science lessons. And they're all available. Like, we made a WordPress blog. Everyone just contributed to it. And now it's just up on the internet at baconwraplessons.com/WordPress. And you just Like, there it is. There's 150 awesome lessons that fix some pretty serious problems. And every time we do it with an organization, we produce this blog, and then the organization can go back and see, you know, these are the things I was having trouble with. And that's our basic model. You know, there's some other, like, funny little things that you do to get people thinking along different routes and inspiration, but that's the Bacon Wrap Lesson Workshop.
That is awesome. It just sounds, so amazing, and it sounds
really, really fun.
Problem-solving oriented in a way that, you know, I always long for. I'm not a traditional faculty member. I don't teach traditional stuff, but I always kind of long for those types of conversations because I hear individual faculty problems, mm-hmm. and then I'm like, great, let's tackle it as a team. But that doesn't always seem to be
the dumbest thing we did.
Sometimes
the dumbest thing we did when we ran the first one was not have a librarian there. Right, we got halfway through it, and we thought to ourselves, my God, who is the person that knows a whole bunch of random tools and all they think about is how to use them? Damn it, we forgot the librarian, right? We had math teachers and science teachers and administrators and, you know, Drake professors and stuff, but, you know, so the next one we do, right, we'll have to, like, get the librarian thing figured out. But the coaching part of it was really interesting because the teachers really wanted, after that first sort of triage moment, they then wanted to say, like, well, my kids can't do this part. How do we motivate that? How do we push that? And so it was really fun to have that experience with teachers where they were willing to admit, it's okay that this didn't go well because it's about fixing it. Because teachers don't have that conversation, right? You really do pretend like you're doing an awesome job all the time. At least most teachers kind of do.
Or that you're caught in a system that doesn't allow you to do it a way that you really want to get it done.
Right.
So there's a lot of that blaming, I think, that can happen too. And just saying, well, I'm part of this institution, so what else can I do?
And I mean, I think there's a fair amount, too, of potential blaming of students, in part because Kirkwood does, we have a very, very diverse, like, profoundly diverse group of people.
Bizarrely, I think, is the adverb, right?
You said it, Ami. it's just such a, there are times where I'm boggled at some of our faculty, like, how can you possibly take people at so many different levels and hope to kind of move as a cohesive whole, or some small subgroups of that. And I think sometimes also you can use that, though, as a crutch to be like, well, I can't possibly do this because it's mm-hmm. it's too diverse. I'm not blaming any specific colleagues, but, you know, that is something from time to time I hear. I'm interested in, so a conversation that I have a fair amount and think about is, like, what can we do to motivate students? Like, they're, you know, little atoms that we can excite by pumping energy into them.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of am increasingly thinking, like, that's just, like, it's somehow the wrong question.
It's absolutely the wrong question.
Okay, so help me think through, like, what's a better...
So when someone asks you, how do I motivate students, what they're really asking is, why does my curriculum suck, right? Because everyone's motivated, right? That's a ridiculous thing to say. Some people are motivated and some people aren't. Like, some people are just motivated to do things that we don't recognize as productive, right? Like, I'm very much motivated to eat an entire banana cream pie, right? But that's not, you know, that's playing on my, like, more basal, like, you know, eat sugar, don't die, like, emotion, or, you know, motivation. Like, everyone has a motivation. And for the majority of people in the world, that motivation is not for someone to stand up in front of them and say, all right, chapter 3, get her done. You know, the only people who are motivated by that rhetoric are people who have had success with that in the past. And, I mean, that's not the entire population that attends Kirkwood, you know? There are students here for bizarrely different reasons, right? And not all of them are coming from successful academic backgrounds. So to say, how can I motivate my students better, you know, like, you can't just pick a prettier textbook. You know, if the factory model of education is broken, you can't just repaint the factory and expect it to work better the next day. Like, it doesn't work that way.
But the paint is really shiny.
And they do that. They spend lots of money on buildings and fancy classrooms with clickers and projectors and all sorts of things like that. And good, I'm glad we have updated facilities, you know, to use, right? The whole Pentagon bake sale line of reasoning applies here. But in the end, and, you know, there's so much to balk at this comment, feel free. In the end, no one is letting the students ask a question they actually care about. And there's a lot to balk at there. Well, students don't know enough to ask a question. Mabes. Students don't want to do anything. We have to make them do stuff. Well, I think it's total garbage. Students want to do plenty of things, right? They want to be successful people. And they just don't see how your class is helping them do that. Like, so in the end, like, how do you motivate students? The answer is, like, talk to them, like find out what they're like and who they are. And that's a sucky answer, because if you have a lecture hall full of 100 people, that's not going to work. So the answer is not how do I motivate students, how do I change the fundamental DNA of how Kirkwood educates its kids? And the answer is sticking 100 people in a classroom and expecting them to really, really care about chemistry is a pretty poor idea. Especially because you're not trying to root people out anymore, right? You know, it used to be you could send 100 kids to a chemistry classroom at Iowa and expect 15 to 20 of them to be really, really good, because you only needed 15 to 20 chemists to be really, really good. Well, it turns out now you need an economy of dilettantes, right? You need all these people who are pretty much good and understand a lot of big ideas, because you never have any idea 10 to 15 years down the road what they're actually going to do with their lives. And that's the new economy of information, right? So you have this model of people of education that's designed to kick people out that aren't good enough, but yet an economic model that requires diversity of big ideas in the people and the ability to actually apply those big ideas. I guess what I'm saying is you're going to have to go with smaller class sizes, and you have to actually interview your students during the first couple weeks and get to know what they actually care about, and you have to find out what their career goals are, and you have to find out why they're at Kirkwood and what kind of education experience they're set up for. Because you could say, like, oh, yeah, let's have this hippie big idea school and send everybody there. That's a terrible idea. There's only 20%, 15% of kids that really want that. And that's why options are so important, right? And right now we have this one-size-fits-all insanity in high schools, community colleges, and universities. That's absolutely bonkers. Like, the idea should be options. Like, I was really great at going to Iowa. Good for me, right? Not everybody else. Mm-hmm. So this whole idea of options as opposed to finding the right way to do things. And so I didn't answer your question at all, but...
No, you did, because it's, you know, it's, again, it's kind of a wrong question, but it's, for me, it's how do I think through, not necessarily what's a better question, but what is, you know, you saying, when you ask what can we do to motivate students, that the real issue is my curriculum sucks, like, I think there's real truth to that, and I'm just going to have to kind of continue living with it and unpacking what it means here in this context with these people.
Here's a quote, right, from my mentor, Trace Pickering, right, who's been an educator here in Iowa for decades. He was an English teacher, and he quit teaching English in high school when he realized that there's no way to teach English well in an English teacher environment, because the worst audience for the writing of a teenager is a 30-year-old white dude. You know, like, you're not gonna write your best writing for an audience that you don't want to read your best writing. In fact, I remember writing badly because I didn't want my teacher to find out what I actually could write like. You know, I didn't want to, you know, it's so tied to your identity when you're a teenager, you know, and a young adult, that you almost don't want to open up. Like, I would write 4,000 words on the internet and then could barely eke anything out for this poetry project in high school. Like, and that's not, you know, so the insolence of youth, whatever, blah, 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 blah. Like, you have to stop having contempt for teenagers and realize they're just slightly more concrete adults, mm-hmm. right? And so once you have this realization that the audience suddenly matters way more than the work, well, it's as simple, you know, how do I engage my students? If they believe that you actually are excited about something they're producing, even if it's some crap curriculum, like do this canned chemistry lab, if you actually think if they think you are excited about their analysis of it, you know, comment on this. Tell me how it went. Why do you think this? You know, if they actually think that you're going to read that and take it in as a personal comment instead of just get the right answer, get 0% error, move on. That's a fantastic way to motivate students.
Hmm. I like that, because that seems like something you can kind of apply. I mean, you know, because the hard thing for all of us, whether we're in K-12 education, higher ed, is that there really is a system that we're part of. And as Trace always says, systems do what they're designed to do. Mm-hmm. And many of our systems are designed to rake the wheat from the chaff, you know, help certain people get through, promote certain people, and then just kind of throw the rest away. Mm-hmm. And that in theory, hopefully, we're moving to a system that instead of kind of sorting, we're unfolding the potential of every person. So it's much more centered on the individual, mm-hmm. much more about like them doing what it is they're capable of and interested in doing.
Can I say something about that? So
yes.
I hear that, what you just said, I hear that a lot, and I say that a lot. And I hear that from people like sort of in this circle of trust.
I got it pretty straightforward from Trace. So
yeah.
Yes.
Well, you hear that a lot, like unfold the potential of every child and all sorts of things like that. And I remember being on the outside of this sort of, you know, drum circle of education here. And I just remember hearing that and thinking, you can't unfold. You know, don't give me that liberal nonsense.
Sure.
You know?
Fair enough.
And I just like to say, like, my sort of come to Jesus moment on that was realizing that if I keep educating a bunch of kids to be physicists, I will only educate probably 4 people in my entire career. Hmm. Like, if I stay in teaching for 50 years, like I plan to, and I produce the amount of physicists that are being, on average, produced a year, and I do those numbers backwards, and I, you know, extrapolate backwards, that means that of the thousands of students I encounter, I will only have effectively taught 4, because I'll produce probably about 4 PhD physicists in my 50-year career. And, like, those kinds of numbers, like, just blow your freaking mind. And I think that if you have a more Republican or conservative mindset where you're saying to yourself, they got to want to unfold, you know, personal responsibility, unfold yourself, damn it. Like, yeah. You know, I totally understand that, and I buy that, but teenagers can't do that. Like, they're not, I mean, that's why they're teenagers and not adults. You know, you can't, and even adults have a hard time unfolding their own potential because they don't even understand what it is, you know. So that was really hard for me, and I just, you know, quick bit in there for those people who are a little bit more conservative is that if you don't attempt to actually meet people where they are and pull them a little bit further, you know, even if you don't like where they are, you'll end up just, you know, really cutting off 96% of what you actually are, you know, interacting with, which is that's not an attrition rate I can handle. That made me insane.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way to think about it. So along the lines of kind of unfolding the potential of every child, it is a cheese ball term. It's kind of an awkward way to say it. I mean,
but it's true, right?
It's true.
It's so cheesy, it's true.
Yeah, right? Totally. So, I mean, I think, you know, Alan and I have had this conversation a little bit before where I sort of talk about, you know, I really feel like anything I've learned to do well in my life, like I kind of had to do alone, which is kind of a slap in the face to every teacher, parent, like, adult in my life. It's kind of like, screw you guys, I did this myself, which is kind of untrue. I mean, I had a lot of people helping me along the way. You know, even, like, a college English teacher, you know, he helped me learn to be a better writer. It wasn't in the way I think maybe he was intending me to, but just, you know, I learned more, like, how to better regulate my time or something like that. I don't know where I'm going with this, but I think that it's right that teenagers can't unfold themselves and adult can't unfold themselves, but they're still the pilot that has to be like, Alan, I want you to help me do this thing. I want you to help push me in this way. Mm-hmm. So I really think there's something to every student is at the end of the day going to be alone by themselves and have to decide, what am I going to do? Am I going to do my homework? You know what I mean? So there's like a weird individual component to the unfolding where in the dark soul of the night, it's going to be you alone and you're going to have to decide, am I going to do this homework? Am I going to confront this material? Am I going to learn this? Am I going to let this in? Am I going to keep this? Am I going to incorporate this into my identity?
So that means that, and I agree with you, you know, you can't make somebody learn anything.
Yeah.
Right? No matter how pretty the textbook is, no matter how expensive the lab fee was,
right?
In the end, that's still not motivation enough to learn something, right? So the question then is, do you design a school system that believes in a psychology where you force people to do things and you force assessment on them, or do you design a school system that's full of experiences that are rich enough for people to put together and the assessment system is more of an emergent assessment system where you're saying to yourself, okay, I gave you these 30 experiences, you know, we paid for that, we got this equipment, you know, you did this, you did that, you spent this time at this internship. And now let's emerge some content from that. Let's put that together. Let's look at the common core standards, like the stuff everyone's supposed to know when they graduate from high school. How many of these do you know? How many of these do you need to work on? How many of these do you have to know? You could, like, just kind of get there, you know, if we did something else. And that conversation is so powerful. And to me, that's the, like, guided sort of unfolding that we're talking about. I mean, when you sit down with a kid and say, hey, here are the 40 things you're supposed to know at the end of a calculus class. How many of them do you actually know? Like, kids are, like, bluntly honest with you. They're like, I bet I'm good at 2 of those. And, you know, we then, if you're in college, you just curve the test then and pretend that didn't happen. But if you're really educating people to understand calculus at a level, like, I'm not okay with that. And so you say to the kid, okay, well, are you going to quit and know that you're not good at calculus and that you should study that at some point in the future? Or are you going to pretend that you're not? Or are you going to keep going? And most students choose keep going, even though it's I have students that have been taking biology for 3 years now at Solon because they just weren't old enough to get biology when they're supposed to take it as sophomores. Some kids are still sixth grade mentally when they're sophomores in high school. You can't teach a kid evolution when they're sixth grade mentally. The Earth is literally nine zeros older than you. You can't buy that when you have a sixth grade mindset. Like, it's not going to happen. But yeah, we teach it all to all 10th graders, pick the ones who happen to be genetically more mature, and say, you're good students. The other of you, like, go play football and get brain injuries. Like, this is ridiculous, you know? And so the whole idea that there's, like, time on this is just so bonkers, right? So I think, you know, experience is the only way to unfold people, because in the end, you sit at home and you say, yeah, I'm going to unpack this internship and this lab I did. Those go together. And you, to us, like, that seems so obvious. Of course they go together. But to a teenager, it's, like, mind-blowing. Like, oh, this thing I learned in school applies to this thing someone else does for money? That, like, has never occurred to them before. Right? It's, like, the first time you figure out, like, oh, man, maybe, like, Holden Caulfield is, like, an allusion to something else. And you, like, have that first moment where you first get a book. You're like, oh, man, every book is like this. The Hobbit's not just about dwarves. Ah! You know, like, you don't... Like, you, like, teenagers have never had that moment, you know?
So, go ahead, Alan.
Do you see a lot of, do you see, with shifting the time maybe, is do you see a future where schools would have a mix of ages, so it wouldn't just be teenagers anymore? Because...
Oh, yeah.
Because we have students who can't get through that material that fast, and so they're still in it when they're 20 a year.
I see a school where 14 and 15-year-olds don't go to school and they get a job. And they find out what it's like to work 40 hours a week at Hy-Vee or dig ditches or do the kind of work that unskilled labor can do, do the kind of work that the rest of the world has to do. Like, that's what I really see, because those ages, 13, 14, 15, are the roughest educationally. Like, students aren't mentally interested in necessarily getting, you know, academic sort of abstract educations. And those are the ages where we lose kids, 13, 14, 15. Those are the ages where their brains are in all sorts of bizarre places. They're thinking about all sorts of weird things, right? Literally, their emotions are uncontrollable, right? And instead, we sit them in a pre-algebra class and say, that you give a shit about fractions, please. And they're like, I'm writing a note to my friend because that's the only thing that can matter right now. And that's the reality. Right? I mean, well, I mean, you know it's worthless, and they won't care about it in literally in 2 months, they won't care about it. But at that moment, like, that's what they believe in. So I see a place where you have a lot of kids going out and doing physical, like, doing work and actually getting some life experience. So they come back to high school, they think to themselves, my God, like, I don't want to do that for a living. Like, I want to do something meaningful. I had some experience there that elucidates why math is important. You know, and I think that the community needs to be involved in shepherding those students because they're so young through those experiences. And I'm not saying, you know, I'm not advocating for child labor, but I'm saying, like, those students need to have that experience, and they don't. And so you have a whole crap ton of 17-year-olds leaving high schools or coming into their senior years in high school who have these really very young mentalities about what work is and what interest is and what talent is. And, I mean, you have kids that will tell you things like, I'm bad at math. You're 17. You can't possibly know that. You don't even have an adult brain yet. How can you? I mean, if at 17, if I maintained all of the skills I didn't have then, I wouldn't be able to do any of the things I do now. I mean, it's a ridiculous mindset to have to breed into teenagers. So I see a school where kids really what they have is a list of the common things that everyone should know. And that list is correlated back to the things they've done that show that they get it or have experienced that, you know. And I mean, I'm you know, break those things down into, you know, evolution, genetics, you know, all the biology things, and all of your sort of like math big ideas, and all of your physics big ideas, and all of your English big ideas, you know. And literally, you have this portfolio, right? And then that portfolio is spiderwebbed to the myriad experiences that kid has had. Kid went to Rotary Club, presented on solution for cleaning up, I don't know, battery waste in a landfill. That is a perfectly valid English experience. In fact, it's more valid because the speech they probably would have given to their English class persuading kids to clean up a landfill would have been garbage. And it's not because English teachers are garbage. It's because the system that, you know, the system does what the system does. So I see a school where, you know, it's purely competency-based, and that's what big is. I mean, the kids, you're not, you know, if you get to the end of the summer session and you didn't get calculus, your choices are to quit and cry about it, or enroll in the second semester and, like, get the five things figured out that we know you don't understand.
So what about How valid is it to assume that all students need to know a certain amount about physics? I mean, you know, we all experience the physical world. Like, I understand if I drop this pen, it's going to hit the ground. I mean, I guess that's... how important is it that everybody understand, like, some of the more academic things? So, like, I mean, if we're thinking among a sort of common core type thing, like, mm-hmm. is it valid to assume everybody has to know all of these things?
Yeah, I mean, and students ask that question a lot, except they ask it in a way meaner way than you just did.
Why do I have to know this?
Yeah, I'm never going to use this, Mr. Cornelli. Like, yeah. Well, actually, that's all we talk about. Your example is actually really poignant, right? So physics is the most esoteric but yet applicable material in the universe. You know, that's like sort of almost a pun, right? So you have this curriculum where you teach kids how stuff falls, which to kids seems so stupid. But what you're really saying is, like, can you develop a predictive model for how the real world will behave so that you don't have to, like, break stuff before you build it? You know, like, that's such a different way to think of it. You know, like knowing that a pen is going to fall is a silly thing to know. Like, everyone knows that. But, like, knowing the nanosecond it will hit the ground and if it's going to destroy the pen, that suddenly becomes, like, a meaningful predictive model. Sadly, we don't do stuff like that in physics class normally, right? So to me, you come back to this narrative art question. Are you actually asking a question that somebody in the real world would actually care about? Like, if you were sitting around at Christmas dinner and your uncle said, you know, I think there's aliens, that becomes a question that you now suddenly, like, want to talk about. And that's the kind of crap we should be doing in school, right? That's a valid question. You know, it sounds crazy. But we don't. We ask questions like, okay, kids, what was the time it took for the pencil to fall 3.41 meters? When it was thrown down at 4 meters per second at an angle of 6 above level? Those are not questions people actually ask, but that's mathematics that someone would actually do from a better context, right? And so I guess that's the first thing I would respond to that is, I don't know that everyone needs to know everything in the Common Core, because you can't, I mean, if I could predict the future, right, I probably wouldn't be here, right? I would probably, like, I don't know what, I'm making a whole lot of money from the stock market. But... I had a student ask me this right last week, and I couldn't think of a good answer other than to say, McKenna, no one can possibly know when they need to know anything, but the fact that I know things about random topics informs the work I do, even though it doesn't have to. Mm-hmm. You know, this idea that we have a librarian who will also record a podcast and do some audio engineering and be interested in whatever it is you're interested in, that flavors your librarianship, right, in a way that's deeper than... You know, if you had just done the things that were one standard deviation away from the word librarian, okay, I'm sure you'd be good at putting books away and, like, Googling things, but, like, that's not really what kids are asking for when they interact with a human, right? And so I feel that same way. Like, do I really need to be a good programmer, right? That's a skill that I've taught myself recently that I'm proud of. Do I need that to be a physics teacher? No. But does it, like, make me a better physics teacher? Yes. Like, way yes, you know? And it's the same thing with the Common Core. Like, do I think every accountant really needs to be able to calculate the gravitational force between Jupiter and its moons? No, but if they get why that model is, like, somehow predictive and, like, powerful, that makes a better accountant. And I can't tell you how, but I know it does. And so, in the end, it always comes back to, like, are the kids actually doing a question or working on something that someone would actually find interesting?
Yeah. So how, I mean, maybe my question centers around the predictive... predictive is not the right word. Like, in advance, do you plan, or, like, why is it valid to say these are the things you need to know? You know, do whatever projects you want to get here, but that at the end of the day, you still have to know about, you know, science and literature and stuff. Because again, if we're addressing real world problems and project based scenarios, you're going to get a lot of that stuff. But, you know, I guess it's kind of like, how much do you plan at the beginning, maybe in the big ideas mm-hmm. group context? You know, because I think at the end of the day, if you're still coming back to students and saying, oh, you know, there's these 40 things, and you still only know two, got to do these other 38, you know, mm-hmm. that to me somehow sounds disingenuous. Does that kind of make sense, what I'm saying?
Sure, and I struggle with that. The first thing I would say is that there are these big ideas that show up no matter what you do. So if you're studying, if you're asking physical questions, like, how does Jupiter work, right? No matter what, there are some things that you're going to have to grapple with. And to me, that's the Common Core. Like, those are my standards, right? So if a kid asks, I mean, there are questions that people find very, like the aliens question, right? Everyone loves to ask the physics teacher about aliens. I don't know why. There's not a class about aliens, right? But everyone asks the physics teacher, do you believe in aliens? And to me, the answer to that question requires some really serious understanding of biology. And you can't really answer that question in any meaningful way without knowing some statistics, knowing a lot about carbon, and a lot about DNA, and a lot about evolution, and a lot about natural selection, and then a lot about planetary science and astronomy. So that actual question that someone would actually ask demands what we call the Common Core. Now, the Common Core itself, the actual Common Core standards with their fancy graphic designs, a whole bunch of like barfed out circles in Adobe Illustrator. It looks like someone just like accidentally, like, you know, you know how that happened, right? The actual Common Core is written in teacher speak for teachers, for people who believe that they can teach kids, that they believe that their face is somehow motivating enough to teach people stuff. And that, of course, I reject that whole hog. That's garbage, right? But the idea, if you distill down the Common Core into the central things that actually show up, that's fine to me. Like, you know, there's no way to get around the basics of chemistry or physics or English. Like, there's just no way to do that, right? The comma becomes necessary, but the comma is not itself necessary. You know what I mean? Like, it could be any other symbol that performs that same task. And so I want that kid to understand, like, comma with a capital C, rather than, like, this is a clause, this is a derp, this is a, you know, I mean, you know, again, I give you the hippie answer, which is they learn the things they learn because it actually happens. And as a teacher, my only job is to, like, yellow flag all those moments. Like, kid was working on Lego robot. Lego robot kept breaking when it tried to pick up a dumbbell. Talk about torque. You know, like, that, like, those sorts of things, like, suddenly matter. And you don't even tell the kids you're writing that down. And then you start, the next day, you're like, hey, sit down. I think we should talk about torque. And they're like, why? And you start doing it, and you like are 3 minutes in. You like stop. Like, wait, where does this show up in real life? And they're like, Lego robot. God, that was my problem. Like, yes. Okay. Let's do some math. And yes. No.
Okay.
Yes and no. Right. The Common Core is written for people who believe in poor motivational psychology, I think. But in the end, I mean, it's all the same big ideas over and over and over again.
Within the big ideas, do you worry about? Different facilitators, instructors, whatever, I guess, what is your term for the teacher in the
big That's a good question. I think we use the word mentor.
Mentor, right. Nice.
Right.
So do you worry any about the different mentors assessing the work differently that students are doing, saying this does meet that standard or this
It's one always by committee. So not really. No student ever gets credit without the entire school acquiescing to that credit, right? And that group of assessors also includes a community or public component, right? Whether it's their parents, whether it's a person at Rockwell, whether it's a person who works at the art museum, whether it's a professor, right? There's always this. It's assessment by committee, and you know, if I don't agree, but there's six other adults that think that was really valid, then you know, I'm off that day. You know, I might just being too liberal that day. And that's a perfectly valid thing that society accepts. So it's sort of like assessment through, you know, democratized assessment in a sense. I do worry in the sense that the big idea school demands a certain kind of pedagogy from the teacher, right? You're, like I said, those little yellow flags, but you're not willing to interrupt the kid until you have to. And this how to pull a project out of a kid without just giving it to them, you know, like that's a delicate dance because kids can't do that on their own, but if the teacher does all the work, it's worthless. So these things are very delicate, and that's why I believe in options. I absolutely believe in educational options. It's not about I have this right way to teach and it's right. It's there are 15% of children who are fit for this. There are another 15% who have parents in a family situation where this will work. There are another 15% who have a family situation where this will work. And the fact that we only have one option right now for everybody, that's killing a serious number, literally some of them, killing a serious number of students. I mean, India and China have serious student suicide problems because of this one-track mind education system.
How do they figure out what system they belong in?
That's a good question. I mean, I guess I would say experimentation, but I don't know. I mean, I think the parents drive a lot of that.
A sorting hat, clearly.
So, right.
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
Right. We're Gryffindor, just in case you're wondering. And normal school is Hufflepuff.
They're not Slytherins? Anyway.
No, because that would be demonization, right? Slytherin would be like Michelle Reed. You don't want to know who Michelle Reed is. Okay. No, she's the chancellor from Washington, D.C., and she implemented a whole bunch of strategic reforms, which essentially was just like firing all the principals at low SES schools and then making them all take tests all the time. Mm. So, you know, Google her if you're looking to get mad about anything.
I have enough to be mad about in my life.
Fair enough.
But thanks. Good to know. So how do you see kind of like, so there's all this interesting energy in our society these days, and especially here in the corridor around like technology, entrepreneurship, co-working, mm-hmm. Kind of this movement toward maker culture is part of that. You know, bar camps and conferences, it's kind of like this interesting information age flowering of human energy that mm-hmm. to me feels very authentic and very invigorating. And I don't know if it's just I gravitate towards that. Like, how do you see that tying into the big idea schools or education, even not the big idea group?
Sorry. That's okay. Obviously, the big idea school really is sort of like co-working for students, right? I mean, it's even involved. Right, so we want the students to experience this co-working environment, but what we really want them to experience is this. How should I put it? This idea that there are things worth pursuing, and those things are psychologically and motivationally independent from school. So school is like I said at the very beginning. My mission is to have students crying on the last day of school because they can't imagine not getting to do this again. Like, that's what I want. You know, like, I felt that way once in my life. I had a class I loved so much, right? And I was like, I can't believe I can't do this anymore. Like, this makes me angry that I can't do this anymore. I like being in this environment, having this mentor, and doing this kind of stuff. I want that for kids. And instead, what I see is kids throwing their books and lighting them on fire. Literally lighting them on fire. Hmm. So, this whole information age revolution thing is really, really, really cool. I think a lot of it is driven by trend. You know, I think the way that we do it, you know, this whole co-working thing and having conferences where everyone just sort of celebrates each other. And I think that's a little bit just trendy. You know, we're going to look back on that and be like, oh, remember the time when everyone just, like, drank coffee and talked about how cool it would be to have a website? You know, like, we'll look back on that a little bit. But in the end, the core idea is really valuable. And that's, do you have a problem whose solution would help humanity? Yes? Okay, work on that. Someone will give you money eventually. That's kind of a cool idea, although a little bit, you know, maybe a little bit uncomfortable, depending on your mindset. And we want students to experience that. Like, trust me to be an adult who's experienced, who will show you the big ideas from any curriculum, but get at them through things that you actually care about. You know, I would love it if every student from Big left at the end of their experience with something they were actually proud of. I mean, think back to high school. Did you take anything with you that you wanted to show your professors that would identify you as a better writer, as a better illustrator, as a better producer than the other students, or at least give you individuality compared to your other students? No, I mean, we all go to Iowa or wherever, and we all just sort of look like a shambling pile of sweats, right, that goes to class with a bun and, like, sits there and listens to some dude talk about Archaeopteryx, right? Like, you never, like... It's assumed that you don't have anything that proves your individuality, and that makes me sad because when I ask, you know, for instance, my other company, Blue Harvest, just is hiring an intern. We didn't ask what's your GPA. We didn't ask what classes have you taken. We asked, what have you done in marketing that was cool? Show me. Send me a link. Talk to me about it. You know, that's very different than get a 4.0 in marketing 101. Like, meh.
It's an interesting thing here in higher education because, you know, it's so interesting to me. I know lots of people with lots of degrees, and it's kind of like, man, you've never had a job. You don't produce anything, but you got some fancy letters that mommy and daddy helped you pay for. I mean, I'm being a bit crass on that end, but I do think here in higher ed, it really matters in hiring sometimes. You know, not necessarily the work that you did for your PhD, but that you have the PhD. Mm-hmm. And I do think in some of the hiring situations I've been in just in my life, you know, the school you went to matters. Even though I know lots of people, I mean, I went to a fancy private college. I know lots of people who came out of there that I'm like, it's not that they, you know, you find ways to game your way through the system. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's interesting. I mean, we do live in a society where we do need a shortcut to say, are you good or are you bad? And so often it's your educational background. Mm-hmm. So I think it's an interesting shift, and I look forward to increasingly kind of, for lack of a better term, merit-based hiring, that's not just based on where you went to school, what degrees you have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose, you know, I'm not out to design a perfect education system. Like I said, I'm out to design a specific option that will serve a specific number of students. And specifically a group of students who aren't being served right now. Mm-hmm. And they're not being underserved either. They're just being inappropriately served. And, you know, they're the ones that are super creative and want to do something, but can get a B or a C and just kind of blah. And they end up kind of mentally dead by the time they get to high school or college where they could be creative. And a lot of my friends ended up that way. So, you know, I guess it sounds like I'm selling a meritocracy here. But what I'm selling is a meritocracy within an environment that I know has a huge amount of inertia towards not that. Mm-hmm. You know, so if in the age of the internet, it's really easy to send your professor a link, mm-hmm. you know, to seancornally.com and say, hey, if you can use me in your lab, here's my stuff. That's way easier than it was even 10 years ago to send somebody a paper portfolio that you had to photocopy every single piece. I mean, people did that, I guess.
Sure.
You know, and then no one read it because they have these huge stacks of portfolios from every applicant.
Yep.
You know, so just the conveyance of information now is just so much easier. But, you know, making a point about the internet is not making a point. So I don't know. I guess to me, I'm saying I know that the system won't. I know that we'll retain a GPA-based system for a long time.
Yeah.
I don't think forever, but if there are options within that that are not GPA-based, that will catch more people.
Yeah.
And those people will find their fit in society some other way.
So you mentioned you had a class that when that class ended, you know, you wanted to cry because it was such a great experience. And it made me think about summer camp because mm-hmm. I went to a summer camp for many, many years. And we did. Like, it was an all-girls summer. I mean, we cried and it was like the world was ending and it was this really intense time because we didn't want to leave. And I'm like, those were really meaningful times to me. And I mean, I learned a lot of things there. You know, unexplicitly, but being friends, being good, you know, lots of all the things you learn at summer camp, I guess, about being a human being. And it would be so interesting to me, because I certainly never had that experience with school. Do you guys have any experiences that you sort of cried and didn't want to leave, you know, that were so fun or so awesome, other than the class you mentioned? A trip you've taken? Travel?
Yeah, well, I mean, I can think of a lot of the most important experience, right, was a professor who took me into his lab and just said, you know what, looks like you don't know any physics, and you're a third-year physics major. Your choice is to drop out or learn physics. And I was like, well, I don't have the money to do anything else. I guess I've got 2 years to do 4 years of work. And he's like, okay, you know, do this. And he would just give me tasks to do. And it was super frustrating, you know, and I hated it because I didn't know how to do any of it. But it was very much, you know, concrete. And he was realizing that, like, my brain just wasn't old enough yet to be doing the work that they were asking me to do. And so when I graduated from graduate school, I was still his employee. Like, it was like 6 years of working for this guy. And then by the end of it, I was just like, man, what? This is how I learned everything. You know, I went to class and suffered through it. But, like, then I would just go to this lab and, like, find out where that principle was happening in vivo, you know, and then that's how I would get it. And so when I had to leave that environment, I thought to myself, man, I wonder if I'll ever learn anything again. You know, actually, I had that, like, feeling. So that's mine. Dr. Professor Skiff, Fred Skiff at Iowa. He's a preeminent plasma physicist, whatever that means. But
yeah. Very cool. Anything for you, Alan?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I look back on, at least in my educational opportunities, and I mean, I have had quite a few pretty decent ones. So, I mean, there's certain math classes, instructors, but I think it really is, it comes down to that individual, that teacher who did take the time to care, who did take the time to get to know me. I think I have a math teacher who would share puzzles with me, just kind of at random, call me over and say, I got a new one for you. see if you can figure this one out. That drama teacher who really wanted to move me to tears. But every time she tried, I would bust out laughing. you know, those kinds of... I mean, she really cared. She really wanted me to have that emotion. She really wanted me to tap into that emotion for reasons beyond just giving a decent performance, but to really experience for myself and to try to get to myself to know me better. Obviously, studying in China, I mean, those are experiences that you never want to end. You always hold on to these people and these places And so, yeah, I think there are those memories, but they are few and far between for me. And there are also those other memories where I'm stuck in a history class filling out crossword puzzle after crossword puzzle because that's the model of instruction. And mm-hmm. And there's a lot more of those examples, I think, than there are those great ones that I hold on to.
You know, there's a lot of people who would say that for all your experiences in China or whatever, that the boring experiences you had were necessary. And I firmly disavow that. I prescribe to, like, the Funkmaster Flex model of education. And I always think of this guy's quote, right? He was the originator of hip-hop, right? Or I guess. You know, he's the guy who literally took the panels off the street lamps to hack into the New York City grid to power his giant stereo systems, to have block parties. Like, he's the block party guy. And he had some quote, and someone asked him, what is hip-hop music? And he goes, well, you know how there's, like, a part of every Stevie Wonder song that you would listen to forever? Like, you know, like in Sir Duke, right, the beginning. You'd listen to that on loop for probably 50 hours. He goes, I just made songs where that was the whole song. You know? And I was like, man, like... So, like, there's all these parts of education that are, like, that first part of Sir Duke. Like, what if I just made a whole school that was just nothing but that? It was, like, the hip-hop model of school. Except, like, you can't say that because, like, we're not street. But, like, you know, what if we made that? And then, you know, whenever a verse or a chorus was necessary, you did it. But in the end, there's this hook to everything you're doing. And that's the, you know, people wonder, why did hip-hop take over the world? Those people aren't talented. Yeah, they're talented at one thing. Making music people want to listen to. Like, I don't care if you don't like rappers or what they're talking about. Like, there's a reason that that music is catchy. And the reason is that they figured out what hooks are and how that actually functions, you know? Don't hide that from people. I mean, there's a reason the Daft Punk album sold a bajillion, you know, copies in 4 seconds. Because it's all hooks. Like, the whole thing is just a hook. It's a hook of hooks, right? That's all their music is. And so why can't we make a school like that? You know, you say, oh, you're going to have these good experiences with drama or on a trip. You know, so I'll study abroad one semester or I'll do some lab at the end of the semester to put it all together. That's crap. That's the hook. Do that over and over and over and over and over again. And then every once in a while have a verse when necessary to explain the plot. You know, like, and if you know what, if that doesn't work for everybody, I'll do it with my 15% of kids and we'll have our little fun, you know, and everyone else can have what works for them.
The thing that's so interesting to me about schools, and and Alan and I talk about this a lot, I don't view myself as kind of a traditional educator, and I wasn't trained as a traditional educator. but yeah, I just lost my train of thought. Where was I going with that? I love the energy that you bring, Sean. Like, it seems awesome and fun and exciting, and it makes me feel excited about education. And it's apparent in your writing, it's apparent in your blog, it's apparent in the projects that you do.
Thanks.
So just a big high five to you. Thank you for doing awesome work.
I suppose I'm just lucky that I stumbled into the thing I like. You know, I know for some people it takes a long time for that to happen. And I just sort of, like, accidentally ended up in a classroom and then woke up and I was like, I like this. Like, this is something I want to be better, you know? Like,
yeah.
I can imagine it's waking up and being a barista and being like, coffee's okay. You know, like...
Yeah, I think it's okay. Well, again, we really appreciate you joining us here at Education Is...
I guess as kind of a wrap-up, our podcast is called Education Is kind of ... I wonder if you could finish that sentence for us today.
I should. You know, I saw that on your guys' blog, and I knew you were going to ask me that, and I still didn't think of an answer. And I would say that education is something that happens whether you want it to or not. And... as a school, you can either choose to codify that and make it a part of the student's life, or you can choose to make it something different that is separate from that student's life. And then the student won't be able to codify it for themselves. And that's the sort of splintered model we have right now, and that's just not cool.
Nice. Awesome. Thanks. Cool. All right. Well, as always, you can visit us online at www.educationis.us. Thanks for listening.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.